You're listening to The Recap, first broadcast on the 30th of August 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello, I'm Ben Ryland, and welcome to The Recap, bringing you the highlights from the past week's live news and analysis programs, broadcast right here on Monocle 24. Over the next half hour, I'll bring you some of the very best interviews and reports from The Globalist, The Briefing, Midori House, and of course, The Monocle Daily. Coming up, we'll hear what the mechanics of re-establishing a diplomatic relationship are, and what can go wrong.
Irresponsibility of one of the sides or both of the sides, and that's what we saw with what happened 4 years ago in the relation between Britain and Iran, and in many ways is how to find a way back in maintaining these relations and the interest.
We'll also discuss the aftermath of Wednesday's Virginia shootings and the various ways media treated the news story.
It's this judgment call that editors, whether they be news editors at Sky, at the BBC and at CNN, or whether they are in a newsroom in Fleet Street, whether or not where you press pause on that thing and when you decide to editorialise and tell people, tell your readers why you're not showing them and what that reason is rather than going for the splash.
And then conflicts and food. Ukrainian-born author and chef Olya Hercules explains how last year's Crimean crisis prompted her to write a cookbook on her home country's rich culinary heritage.
When you're hit with something like that, you just suddenly get into this frenzy of, we need to preserve something. We don't know what will happen tomorrow. That's what we thought. Those traditions, those recipes, those bits of history, I thought it was important to start writing them down instead of just keeping them in our heads.
All that and much more coming up in the next half hour right here on The Recap with me, Ben Ryland. Let's start the program by re-establishing some diplomatic relations. When UK Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond shook hands with Iranian President Hassan Rouhani this weekend, it may have looked like a reversal of policy, but it wasn't. In reopening the UK embassy in Tehran, 4 years after it had been chased out of town by an angry mob, Hammond was merely acknowledging the age-old wisdom of that wiliest of British prime ministers, Lord Palmerston, to the effect that nations have no permanent allies, only permanent interests. This rapprochement comes a matter of days after an exchange of embassies between Washington and Havana, something that would have seemed next to impossible for most of the post-World War II period. So how does it all work? What are the mechanics of re-establishing a diplomatic relationship? And what can go wrong? Well, on Monday's edition of The Monocle Daily, Andrew Muller and Dominic Reynolds were joined by Yossi Meckelberg, Program Director of International Relations and Social Sciences at Regent's University, and Tim Marshall, editor of thewhatandthewhy.com and former diplomatic editor of Sky News.
This is a very realist approach to international relations. At the end of the day, it's not about only personalities. Personalities matter. But at the end of the day, is the long-term interest, and of course, the economic interest, the political interest, the strategic interest, all directs to the fact that Iran and Britain have common interest to have actually good enough relations for all this reason. But sometimes events take over, irresponsibility of one or the sides or both of the sides, and that's what we saw with what happened 4 years ago in the relation between Britain and Iran, and in many ways is how to find a way back in maintaining these relations and the interest.
Tim, you've reported from Iran many times, and in terms of finding a way back to a relationship, as Yossi was mentioning there, how difficult would it have been for Britain to decide whether they were letting Iran off the hook a little easily? I mean, going back to what I think is my favourite diplomatic insult of all time, which was Iran in 1981 renaming the street the British Embassy was on from Winston Churchill as then was to after Bobby Sands, which it always gives me hope that shows that the Islamic Republic does have a sense of humour. But they didn't protect the embassy in 2011, as they are obliged to do. On this occasion, at the reopening, they hadn't even troubled to scrape off the Death to England graffiti above a portrait of the Queen.
That was a nice touch, I thought.
I thought so. How difficult would it have been for England to calibrate, or Britain rather, to calibrate, of are we being taken for fools here?
4 years.
Well, indeed, so.
Since 2011. It goes actually all the way back to 2003. I was there when Jack Straw, the then Foreign Secretary, went over with him. And between 2003 and last week, when Hammond went, no foreign secretaries met between Iran and that. So you fast forward from 2003 to 2011, relations are getting worse. Then the mob storms, as we know, with a sort of nod and a wink from the Islamic State. And so you have to rebuild from 2011. And it took 2 years before William Hague, who was then Secretary of State, met his opposite number in New York at the UN. Every year they have the UN General Assembly. It's a great opportunity to meet in the margins. So these two were able to meet in the margins 2 years ago. From that, they then, in November 2013, announced chargé d'affaires, would live in their own countries, but they would actually at least be chargé d'affaires.
The non-resident chargé d'affaires, to use the correct euphemism.
Then, and this was the key, Rouhani replaced Ahmadinejad, so the atmospherics now start to get better. Mr. Hague last year said, OK, once practical arrangements will be made. Cameron met Rouhani at the UN General Assembly last autumn, and the final bit of the jigsaw is the Americans actually did a deal with Iran, at which point the Brits thought, OK, you know, we've put the building blocks into place. We've now got the green light. The deal's been done. We'll reopen the embassy.
And all of those building blocks having been put into place in that way that you sketch out, they can, presumably, a lot of damage can still be done in the diplomatic expression, yes, in the language. And there's been some really interesting language, hasn't there? This idea that Hammond's talked about a deep legacy of distrust. That gave me pause. Did it give you pause?
You can pull out 7 or 8 really nice, warm sentences from his speech that he gave when the embassy opened on Sunday. But you can also pull out those, and they are in there exactly for that reason, to say, yeah, look, we all love each other now, but don't think we've forgotten what you did, and don't think we're not still watching. And by the way, we haven't still got ambassador level yet. We're only still at charge d'affaires. And there's all sort of little things that can be made into problems when people want to make them into problems. And my favourite is that not many people know this, but Iran still owes £72,000 in parking tickets, unpaid parking tickets, from London, from the embassy, when it was open. And if the Brits wanted to make an issue out of it, they would. Yossi and I were talking just before about the Cuba-US, how long that took, 54 years. Again, there's all sorts of things in that, such as the Havana said, how can we open a bank? We're on your terrorist list. And they said, well, we'll deal with that later. Just open an embassy. You know, there's 1,000 little things that if you want to make a problem, you can make a problem.
Yossi Meckelberg there, Program Director of International Relations and Social Sciences at Regent's University, and Tim Marshall, editor of thewhatandthewhy.com and former diplomatic editor of Sky News here in London, speaking to Monocle's Andrew Muller and Dominic Reynolds on Monday's edition of The Monocle Daily. You're listening to The Recap on Monocle 24. In recent weeks, we've reported on the crisis that was made visible at the Hungary and Serbian border, where Hungary's been building a fence to keep out migrants trying to reach the presumed safety of the European Union. Hungary has faced some fierce criticism, as has Macedonia, where police last week fired stun grenades at migrants trying to cross the border. But what of Serbia? Its Prime Minister says his country won't build walls or put migrants in containers. So, why take that stance? And is this a chance to score points for Serbia, which is itself trying to enter the European Union? Well, our Belgrade correspondent, Guy Delorne, joined Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck on the line on Tuesday's edition of The Briefing.
Firstly, Serbia has recent experience of a refugee crisis of its own. In the 1990s, it's a little-known fact that more ethnic Serbs were displaced during the Balkan conflicts than members of any other ethnicity. The Serbs had a reputation of being ethnic cleansers, but they were also seriously cleansed as well. And tens of thousands of people ended up in refugee camps in Serbia, some of which are still open today, one of which I'm going to visit this afternoon, funnily enough. And so I think there's a lot of empathy towards people who find themselves in a tough situation like these refugees coming through from the Middle East. The second of which is, I think Serbia is, as you mentioned in your introduction, Andrew, taking this opportunity to look good. It's seen this coming. It's prepared refugee reception areas where people can get food, shelter and documents that allow them temporary stay in the country. It's told refugees, the Interior Minister, we want you to feel safe while you're here. Well, if on the one hand you've got a neighbour building a razor wire fence and another one a neighbour firing stun grenades, suddenly Serbia looks good.
Now tell me, obviously, when they then get to the Hungarian border, the Hungarians, you know, they're putting up this fence, they're saying, you're going to have to turn back. Is that actually happening? And anyway, isn't that just a bit naive? Because if you're a migrant, you can just, you know, turn left and go through Croatia.
Yeah, I mean, it is incredibly naive. And as we've spoken on these programmes before, Andrew, a lot of it is in some ways a little bit of theatre by the Hungarian authorities. Ways will be found around this barrier. And there are questions as well, of course, as to what Hungary's obligations are according to the refugee treaties and conventions that it's signed up to. Does it actually have the right to turn people back? It's trying to claim that Serbia is a safe third country. The European Union does not recognise Serbia as a safe third country for asylum seekers. So I think Hungary is more or less lumbered with this situation, and there's quite a bit of theatre going on to appease a certain audience within Hungary, and also there's definitely a case of the governing party there chasing extreme right-wing votes.
But again, once they get to Hungary, you know the region well. As we've said, you know, people are determined to get to Northern Europe. But do you know whether there's any, you know, EU officials, you know, coming to Serbia, coming to Macedonia, coming to Hungary saying, actually, we need to stop people here? Or is there a general acceptance now that this notion of, you know, you claim asylum in the first country that you reach in the EU, that's out the window, and that actually everyone is just going to come to the north?
Well, theoretically, of course, we've got these Dublin agreements, which all the EU countries have signed up to, which are exactly that, that as somebody is identified as a refugee in an EU member state, they are identified, their fingerprints are taken, and they have to claim asylum there. Now, that would leave Greece well and truly lumbered with tens of thousands of people. Greece hasn't been trying very hard, let's put it mildly, to register all the people that are coming through its territory. And even though those which are registered are coming back out again through Macedonia, Serbia, back into the EU at Hungary, and eventually turning up in Germany, Sweden, Norway. And we're now finding that Sweden and Norway aren't even making any effort to send people back to the place where they were first registered, i.e. Greece or perhaps Hungary. They're accepting them. And this word is going on down the line. Greece and Hungary are very unhappy that other EU countries haven't been quick to share what they've referred to as the burden of the number of refugees coming in, as the border states that they're taking everything on. And let's face it, they're not the countries which are in the strongest situation economically or in terms of infrastructure to handle such a large number of refugees.
That was a snippet from Tuesday's edition of The Briefing here on Monocle 24, featuring our Belgrade correspondent Guy Delaunay and Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck. This is The Recap on Monocle 24. Let's continue now with the question of who's to blame for the disaster that was the Iraq War. According to former UK Labour Minister Clare Short, the government's inquiry into the war will find that everyone's to blame and no one's to blame. Short has expressed her anger at Sir John Chilcot's investigation, saying the draft report is as big as War and Peace, yet of very, very poor quality. It's emerged that the report will cast its net wider than former Prime Minister Tony Blair and his team, and Short herself is the first official mentioned within the report to speak out against it.
This war was going to happen. The Americans were hell-bent on invading Iraq. Now, Tony Blair, for whatever reason, thought it's better for us to be involved than not be involved. So he wanted to take Britain into the war. This inquiry could only happen in Britain, of course. In any other developed industrial country, it would be Parliament, a parliamentary committee of some sort, doing that kind of thing. Raffaello is looking at me.
Well, I'm just
quizzically.
Thinking the US, didn't they?
The Senate committee.
Was that a Senate committee? Yeah. I mean, I thought it was an independent commission, no?
It was an independent commission, but it was...
But it was quicker. I'm wrong, you're right.
No, but what was interesting about that was it was all in public, pretty much, and it had a timetable, it was bipartisan, and it came out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, unlike, for example, what's happened here, where, I mean, this is going to be the fourth inquiry to concerning events surrounding the Iraq War, but this is the first one that's actually about the war itself. And Raffaello, there has been an awful lot of criticism because it has taken so long. You know, this started in 2009. That's 6 years.
Yeah.
You know,
well, this is why Clare Short's saying it's longer than War and Peace. I mean, they spent a lot of time writing this thing, you know. No, I think it has taken a ridiculous amount of time to come out. And if I've understood correctly, the hindrance seems to be the fact that everyone who's mentioned in the report has to get a chance of coming back and responding to the criticisms before they come out. And it's called the Maxwell effect for reasons that I'm not totally sure about. But I think this...
I know I what it is, but it's, Robert it'll Maxwell take three, who, it'll okay, take 3 minutes to explain. Yeah. Let's not go there. There's a process where everyone who's criticised gets a chance to see their criticism before the report's published and respond.
Exactly. So I think this is what's held the entire process up, and there's been all sorts of, you know, surreptitious leaks in the media hinting that, oh, it's Mr. T. Blair who's holding it all up, or, oh, it's someone else. And I saw the chief of staff, General Houghton, seems to got some stick in the newspapers a couple of weeks ago. I mean, the reality is that when this finally arrives, I can't imagine it's going to tell us anything we didn't already
know, isn't it?
And I just wonder, in some ways, I suspect that it's going to be, what the newspapers are going to be full of is whatever emotive adjective Mr. Chilcott has injected into the body of the text around certain individuals. So, you know, I just don't know if this is really going to have a huge value at this point anymore. You know, I suspect that there's probably a few millions that have gone into this that probably could have been used with a better purpose.
That was Raffaello Pantucci there, Director of International Security Studies at the London-based think tank RUSI, or the Royal United Services Institute, and Sebastian Borger, a London-based correspondent for German media, speaking there to Monocle's Steve Bloomfield on Wednesday's edition of Midori House. You're listening to The Recap on Monocle 24. After the break, we'll look at the ways media covered the recent shooting of two television journalists in Virginia. And Ukrainian-born chef and author Olia Hercules tells us how the crisis in Crimea prompted her to release a cookbook of the rich culinary heritage her home country has. Stay tuned.
Every Sunday, the Bulletin with UBS goes behind the numbers and the hype to explain what's really happening in the world of finance. Brought to you from the desks of the key analysts at UBS and experts from around the world, the programme delivers definitive insights into the people, places and products set to shape the week ahead. This is the show that explains how a fast-moving financial world really works. Set your agenda for the week ahead. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every Sunday at 1800 hours Tokyo time, 1600 hours London time, 11 a.m. in New York. Anytime after that, you can download from monocle.com and via iTunes or SoundCloud. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.
This is The Recap on Monocle 24, a look back at our coverage of the week gone by in live news and analysis programs here on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. When two television journalists were shot dead during the week, during a live broadcast in Virginia, the all-too-familiar debates about gun control ensued. Would the suspect, a former employee of the station WDBJ7, have carried out such an attack in a country with better arms control? And when will America change its ways, if ever? But another debate was also clear. How should the media treat such a story? Should outlets have broadcast footage of the attack? Should they have shown the film made by the suspect, which he later appeared to have posted online? And what of the facts he reportedly sent to ABC News? This is what Monocle's editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé discussed with Ivor Gaber, professor of journalism at Sussex University here in the United Kingdom, and our culture editor Robert Bound on Thursday's edition of The Briefing.
What is interesting is how rolling news has sort of come of age because of social media, in a sense, that when the media becomes the story on the media that it's been talked about, it's very meta, but it's very interesting. And it's the discussion at what happens when news editors have to put their foot on the brake rather than their foot on the gas with the story, which is the holy grail of rolling news, is actually having footage to talk about, footage to show, footage to discuss. But essentially with this, are we being shown it to shock us and we want to rewatch something that we find shocking? Or are we learning something new about the world and maybe about gun crime and American culture by watching this? I'd suggest perhaps we're not.
Ivor, just at Sussex University, does this bring about also a change in terms of standards and practices at the major social media players, do you think? Or does it you know, continue as business as usual? The fact that this can get up there, do there need to be a few more probably hurdles and roadblocks, do you think? Because obviously, you know, we're able to somehow sort of determine if you can see breasts and other things, and these sort of, you know, can get pulled down almost, you know, electronically. And I wonder if there's a way of also intervening so these things don't happen in the future.
Well, I think that breaches the First Amendment, the Americans would say. They would get very uptight about some sort of automatic controls, cutting out things. In this country, we take a more measured view, but it's very, very difficult with the speed of social media, 24-hour news and so forth, to make these measured judgments. I mean, I go back to the days before then where you did have time, you knew, oh, the next bulletins in 3 hours' time, we'll have an in-depth discussion, we'll consider the pros and cons. Those days are long gone, and I think it makes the job of journalists who want to be first, who want to have the best story, very difficult. But that's not to say they don't often get it wrong, and I have to say, I think today's front page of The Sun, which looks to me a bit photoshopped just to overemphasize the tragedy, does go beyond the pale.
Mm. Rob, we were looking at the North American front pages. I was saying, Dan, it's interesting that, you know, the top of the fold of the New York Times this morning, they're not running with that story, they're running with New Orleans.
Yeah.
And what was actually, I thought, quite remarkable is how many, you know, on this side of the Atlantic, how many UK papers have actually gone almost full page with this?
How many UK papers have gone full page in it? I looked at the FAT, the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, it's not on that front page, it's not on the Süddeutsche Zeitung, it's on La Repubblica, but it's not on Le Monde, but it's very splashy in the UK press. Maybe it tells you the tone of voice that the British editors employ, none more so, as Ivor was saying on the line, The Sun newspaper. Mm. And as I say, it's this judgment call that editors, whether they be news editors at Sky, at the BBC and at CNN, or whether they are in a newsroom in Fleet Street, whether or not where you press pause on that thing, and when you decide to editorialise and tell your readers why you're not showing them and what that reason is, rather than going for the splash.
Ivor Gaber there, Professor of Journalism at Sussex University here in the UK, and Monocle's culture editor Robert Bound talking to our editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé on Thursday's edition of The Briefing. This is The Recap, and I'm Ben Rylan. Well, this week's series on Monocle 24 was all about politics and food. This week we've heard about how the Chinese government wants to promote the consumption of potatoes and why French chefs are in a row over steak sauces, just to name a couple of topics. Well, on Friday we heard from Ukrainian-born, London-based chef and author Olia Hercules, who has released the cookbook Mamushka, Recipes from Ukraine and Beyond. Olia's hometown in Ukraine is right next door from the Crimean border. She caught up with Monocle's Marcus Hippy to tell us how the crisis in Crimea and Russian annexation of the region led her into writing the book and trying to bring more attention to Ukrainian food.
I don't think that ever in my life I've been scared before, really. It was a really strange time. There we were, the country, and then all of a sudden, somewhere very near to me, because I live right by Crimea, and my region, the Kherson region, supplies Crimea with water, basically, with fresh water. Suddenly this happens, and I used to wake up sort of at 3 o'clock in the morning and just obsessively checking the news. You know, when your family is so close to somewhere where, you know, weird things like that are happening, you just don't know what to think, and it was one of the hardest times of my life, I think.
And then you started collecting recipes. You spoke on the phone with your mother and collected recipes.
Yeah, you know, when you're hit with something like that, you just suddenly get into this frenzy of, you know, we need to preserve something. We don't know what will happen tomorrow. That's what we thought at the time. We didn't know if my family would have to leave or something, even though my mom and dad said, we're not leaving anywhere, we're staying here. This is our house, this is our country, you know, that kind of mood. But at the same time, you never know. So those traditions, those recipes, those bits of history, I thought it was important to start writing them down instead of just keeping them in our heads.
And then as a result, you released the book Mamushka just some months ago to show support, essentially, to your country, to your home country.
Yeah, it was totally a nod to Ukraine, to my country via my family, I guess.
And when you look at that kind of conflict situations and you think about what was going on in your head during those weeks, months, what is your conclusion? How important is food for national identity, for self-esteem?
Oh, it's incredibly, incredibly important. But it's also important to embrace everything else that's come in. So we grew up with loads of Ukrainian dishes, sort of what you'd call authentically Ukrainian dishes. But then at the same time, as you mentioned before, Ukraine is a bit of a melting pot, especially in the south. One of my grandmas has Moldovan roots. another grandma is Siberian who married a Ukrainian. So, you know, we've got dishes from Russia even that I grew up with. And, you know, we've got Tatars in the Crimea, and Ukrainians have always been quite friendly with them. Well, I mean, in the recent years anyway. So we cook their dishes as well. Yeah, so it's embracing your traditions, but it's also being tolerant and open to everything else that's been happening around you, I suppose.
So if you think about the recipes from your hometown there, it's about 1 hour drive away from the Crimean border. What kind of recipes would you suggest our listeners? What kind of food should they sample from there?
It's not actually in my book, but you know how everybody's really crazy about pomegranate molasses in the UK? So I found a recipe, they use it in Georgia and Azerbaijan as well, but for some reason where I'm from it's also popular. It's basically a watermelon molasses. So they take loads of watermelon juice and reduce it into this syrupy liquid basically, and we call it watermelon honey.
And where do you use it?
You just use it as a sweet, almost. You could put it on bread or something, almost like jam. But I want to try a few stews using that, or even like put a tablespoonful into a broth or something. I bet you'd be amazing.
That was Olya Hercules there, chef and author of Mamushka, Recipes from Ukraine and Beyond, speaking to Monocle's Marcus Hippie. Well, we're nearly at the end of this week's edition of The Recap, but before we go, let's finish with a monologue. Today we'll hear from Monocle's Megan Billings, who turns to the public realm in New York City.
Last week, New York's mayor, Bill de Blasio, made headlines by entertaining a proposal to remove the pedestrian plaza from Times Square. The mayor, along with the state's governor and police chief Bill Bratton, have been reminiscing about the darker days of Times Square, when it was a hazard rather than a destination. The mayor's reasoning is a reaction to a group of women situated in Times Square who panhandled topless. De Blasio has said, "As a human being and as a parent, I don't think it's appropriate in the middle of one of the busiest squares in New York City that women should display themselves that way." Toplessness is in fact legal in New York. The statement itself, from the mayor of one of America's most liberal cities, is a far cry from progressive. Threatening to remove public space is conservative to boot. No one on either side of the equation has claimed this area of Manhattan as a paradise. However, since the pedestrian plazas opened in 2009, business has boomed and real estate prices have increased. Pedestrian injuries have also dropped by 35%, and injuries to drivers and passengers in cars fell 63%. In a city that often feels unfriendly, designated public space offers the notion that human beings are actually a priority. While other great cities boast the amount of public space on hand, New York's mayor is contemplating removing some of ours. De Blasio's claim to make Times Square family-friendly is flawed. The draw of the city itself is its people, whether they're street performers or not. It might be the man walking in Soho with a cat on his head, breakdancers in the subway, or a group of topless women in Times Square. Every time someone triggers the phrase, "only in New York," followed by a headshake, that is what makes New York City what it is. Claiming to be family-friendly is certainly not part of the narrative. If New York wants to continue to be seen as a progressive, avant-garde city in the world, one that draws people from other family-friendly cities to visit, removing some of the few places that cater to its residents certainly is not the way. For Monocle, in London, I'm Megan Billings.
And that brings us to the end of this week's episode of The Recap. The show was produced by Marcus Hippie and edited by Sam Impey. Join us again next week to hear some of the very best of our live news programs broadcast right here on Monocle 24. But for now, from me, Ben Rylan, thanks for listening. Enjoy your weekend.